Thanks so much. I have a loud voice. It doesn't need to get anywhere near me. It'll pick me up. Probably about the farthest subject away from Valentine's Day, right? You think if I gave him some thought, I could have come up with some kind of a Valentine's-y day? But no. No, I couldn't be bothered. So I'm just going to talk about how to make decisions, and there's no correlation with Valentine's Day. So rest in that knowledge. You're trying to figure out, what does this have to do? There's none. None at all. All right, so in life, we often have to make, or we get the opportunities to make big decisions, where to live, how much to commit in a relationship, whether to stay in a friendship or a job or a relationship, or whether to do something that people are pressing us to do but we don't want to do, or something that we want to do but people out there don't want us to do. So life is filled with decisions, and very much the Buddha taught, like the existentialists, that the decisions that we make very much determine not only what kind of life we'll have, but also they determine how we make our decisions determine the quality of the mind that we will live in. how we make our decisions is very, very important. Very, very important. We often make decisions in ways that are self-sabotaging. Couple of examples are, well, the first one is that we often make decisions when we're stressed out. We've accumulated a lot of obligations, responsibilities, minor resentments with people that we haven't worked through, feelings of insecurity. And all these little builds up of pressure and tension that we carry around largely physically, we don't carry them around. Often, you know, we'll experience something upsetting that's small, and it'll just be another thing that we pack in, and the body becomes more and more tense. And it just takes one little thing for us to snap and suddenly decide to quit. I've seen people out of the blue quit jobs for the most meaningless little, you know, disappointment, or people make big decisions about marriages and futures and educational commitments simply because they were carrying this array of little stresses that they didn't acknowledge. And the body became so uncomfortable that they needed to change something. And rather than look and address the underlying stresses that were causing the state of discomfort, they decided to change something external. So they quit the relationship, or they break up, or they quit the job, or they quit the... And very often the people around them are like, what was that about? Of course, it's this underlying building up minor, small, little infractions, resentments, petty grievances that we don't acknowledge. And the more we don't acknowledge them and feel them and get in touch with them, the more they become stuff we carry around, is what the Buddha called vedana, or feelings. And then the underlying feeling state becomes so uncomfortable that we have to change something. And so we generally change something out there rather than the real root cause. The second cause of making often poor choices is panic. Unlike stress, which is an accumulation of minor, small resentments, little disappointments, frustrations, panic is when we get one or two pieces of big news that let us know something that we feel, let us know that something important needs to be decided. It could be a health thing, it could be a financial blow, it could be the news that, I don't know, a company we work for is having problems. It could be a million different things, but it's almost invariably something external that leads to a state of, we have to address it right now, immediately. We can't stop, we can't reflect, we can't pause, we can't review life and see, we can't even, for a moment, just continue with maintaining a state of balance. We feel that we immediately need to jump into action. Very often, when we hear bad news or loss, rather than sit with it, we jump in, we feel we need to take charge and run the entire show so that we don't have to even feel the enormity of the loss, death, or whatever we've faced. So there's panic, and then there's stress. Then there's sometimes just an obsessive idea that will pop into the mind, whether it's planted by someone or it's an opportunity or an idea that we've seen somebody else succeed with, or some idea that just suddenly acts like a bellwether and galvanizes the entire mind and body into this obsessive idea. If you've ever known people with bipolar or manic or hypomania, they tend to be wonderkins of this. They're wonderful people to know. Every time you run into them, they've got another money-making scheme that will be the thing that'll solve them and make everything work out, and then 2 weeks later it's something else that has grabbed the mind and taken off with it. Another cause of us often making poor decisions is peer pressure. Jails and prisons are filled with people who were just along for the ride, whose friends said, come on, it's a sure bet, it's a sure drug deal. Nobody will be there in the store looking after us. Nobody ever gets caught, blah, 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 and the next thing you know, bad news. Or sometimes it's just other decisions in life that we make simply because all our friends are doing it, or because we, our families and the people around us tell us it's a good idea, even though in our hearts we know that there's something wrong. Or sometimes in life there's something that we want to do. We want to travel, we want to explore new possibilities, but the people around us, our significant family members or lovers or whatever, don't want us to explore. And so we choose not to follow a path simply because of the pressure. Finally, there's also habit. Doing what we've always done before, getting into our ruts. There's amazing experiments that they've done with rats, and no, this is not, I'm not supporting animal experimentation, but might as well learn from it. And one of the experiments they did was they put rats in this cage where they gave them minor stresses, turning on and off lights or playing sounds. And the rats had a number of ways of dealing with it. They could leave and escape, or if they went through a different hatch than what they went through before, or they could push a lever which would feed them, give them more food. The food would in no way solve the sounds and the flashing lights, but the rats would invariably keep hitting the food lever because they associated food with comfort. And it was something that they did out of habit whenever they were stressed. So they keep hitting the food lever rather than try to find a new way out of the cage. So very often in life when we're faced with a decision we have to make and we're stressed out or we feel overwhelmed, we do what we've always done, which is maybe hide, avoid, run away, or maybe we just make a snap judgment in a direction that we've done before. So you might ask, okay, granted that there's all these ways that we make decisions that can sometimes be shortchange us, what does meditation and Buddhist practice have to do with all this? Well, as it so happens, I practice in a school of the Theravada called the Kama Tahana tradition, which is a tradition that's basically focuses on not only attaining peace and tranquility through practice, but is also very much focused on using meditation and mindfulness as a way to live our lives in a much more skillful way. And they do focus in the school of teaching how to use meditation as a way to reflect and on our lives, and also to review how to make decisions and take inventories of ourselves and know how to go about making changes. It's a very important addition to insight meditation, and it's very useful to me in life when I have to make a decision that often earlier in my life would paralyze me. I can have a mind like, I don't know if you've ever been to Hyde Park. Hyde Park is infamous for its debating. There'd be people on soapboxes. And sometimes there'd be lone people off to the side that were insane. Members of, like, you know, the vegetable, you know, political party. And then there'd be the British National Party, which were basically the fascists. And they'd invariably be arguing with the Socialist Party. And they both, you know, these guys, by the way, when I went there, this was back in the 80s when I'd go there a couple of times, and there was two guys, one who was a fascist and one who was a socialist, and they were like best fucking friends. They would like go off to tea, and then they'd get on their soapbox, and then they'd be shouting at each other and, you know, accusing each of genocide and shit, and then they'd go off. And that's my mind. You know, most of the time it's like, it's very, you know, okay, we're supposed to cross now. Okay, we got to cross the street. Now we're supposed to buy food because it's about that time. You know, most of the time my mind's working pretty dependably. But then, you know, very often you throw us a big decision like, oh, there's a possibility maybe there's a job opening here. And then suddenly, you know, then it would be like a Hyde Park when the Falkland War was about to be declared. Suddenly everybody came out on their soapboxes and there were millions of people arguing and shouting and stuff like that. And the mind is sort of, you know, like that. It's like it's a committee. It's filled with different voices with their own agendas. We've got the fear part of the brain. It's all gonna turn to shit. Fuck it. Don't even bother. They're just offering you this job to trap you. Then there's the opportunist. This could be it, you know. I could actually pay, you know, my bills for a while. Or this, you know, the other part of the social brain. Well, what will other people think if I take this job? And then there's the artist. I'm better than this. I don't have to work. I should be making strange electronic music all the time. Even, you know, whatever. So there's all these different members in there shouting and wanting my attention and tugging away. So how do you make sense of it all? What does meditation have to offer? Well, the first thing is that meditation is very much about finding the ability to get calm at any time in our lives. Rather than having to make a decision or a choice when people are pressing us or when there's when we're presented with an opportunity, we are offered the opportunity in meditation to breathe, relax, release by the scan we did at the beginning. We go through the body and we release all the areas that hold those tensions, those contractions, those grievances that are making us feel like we have to do something right now. You really want to get to the place where you can, before you make a decision, where you feel you don't have to make a decision. That's what I found in life. I make my best decisions when I find I don't have to decide anything, where I don't feel any impulse to decide, when there's nothing pushing me, there's no drive. I met this guy who was a salesman of luxury goods. He was on vacation, and he talked to me. It was not one of those conversations I was dying to have, but but there you go. That's part of life. And he told me that a good salesman knows with luxury goods, expensive goods, life-changing goods, stuff like, you know, I don't know, Mercedes-Benzes or, you know, big, you know, expensive purchases that are going to, you know, require substantial commitments, a good salesman knows that if the one time the customer comes in, the first time, they've got like a 25-30% chance of landing a deal. But if that person goes out and thinks about it and researches it and takes their time, they have less than a 2% chance. So they've gone from 25% down to 2% if they don't make that deal right then and there. So what they do is they throw all these things like, you know, only now I'll take 3% off the deal and I'll offer you this and you'll get an extra tire and, you know, I don't know what the fuck. You'll get a leather steering wheel and, you know, just for this opportunity, because they know that if people take their time, go away, think, relax, get peaceful, that they drive, that the momentum to buy vanishes. That people become smart consumers the moment that they have an opportunity to compare prices and ask, well, do I really need something like this? Is this really the opportunity that it seems to be? So what we're doing in meditation is we're training ourselves, even when there's nothing going on in life, that when we will need to make a really difficult decision, we're training ourselves how to first get peaceful, how to first find a state that is not driven, where there's no momentum, where there's no feeling that I have to right now change everything, that I have to, you know, that I have to, before I talk about it with other people, before I weigh my options, we get to a place where we feel good in our lives as it is right now. We can embrace how we feel right now, so that there's no need to go out there and change. We're not driven into it. When it comes to those voices that come in and take over the mind, meditation allows us to have a distanced approach where when we're sitting and we're meditating and suddenly this idea is there again, this conquering thought, this idea that we're obsessed with. I want to call up my ex-girlfriend. I got to call her back right now. I know last time I called her, it was a terrible idea, but... So there's the idea. And what we can do in meditation is when an idea pops up again, we can look at it from the outside and notice, okay, when I have this idea, what does it do to my breath? Does it change my breath from calm to shallow? What does it do to my body? Do my shoulders start to clench, or my chest, or my jaw? Does this thought, does it talk in a voice that's polite, or does it insult me? That's a good one. Does it repeat itself over and over and over again, as if I didn't get the gist? Yeah, you gotta do this, you gotta do this, oh, by the way, you gotta do this, which is what a lot of my thoughts will do. So I have a way of, one of the things I've learned over, it took me far too long to figure this out, but is that all my good ideas just say them their idea once, really, once or twice. The ones that need to repeat themselves over and over again and come up with all this self-justification and why that person deserves me, you know, giving them my 2 cents and why, you know, I'm justified in this. Those ideas are generally not in my best interest. So I look at them and then I ask myself, is this an idea that I could imagine Ajahn Jeff, one of the monks I've studied with, telling me? No? Okay. Is this an idea that I could imagine telling somebody that I really cared about in the same situation? No, okay, maybe I won't do it. Or is this a idea that I would feel proud if everybody could hear me thinking it? That's a good one too. There's all these different ways we can view thoughts from the outside and test them. In a meditation practice, we can look at them and ask, well, Really, if there was a megaphone attached to my mind and everybody was hearing that I want to shtup this person or fuck over that person, would it be a good idea? No. So these are ways we can begin to work with those thoughts that or these obsessive ideas that come in to the mind. We can develop our own tests for them. And because we have a station with the breath, we're not pulled into their imaginary world. If I'm not here present and a thought that's obsessive comes up, it's not just going to tell me its idea, it's going to paint pictures of how wonderful it will be if I follow it and how bad it will be for me if I don't. But if I stay grounded and present, I can then just hear the thought from the outside as another person. It's no longer me talking, it's just a thought. And I can evaluate it. I've got distance between me observing it and the thought's idea. And that's a very important technique to learn how to deal with obsessive thoughts. When it comes to peer pressure, the Buddha taught that people will like us if we will not like us if we talk too much, too little, or just the right amount. There always will be somebody or a group of people that will be giving sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes meaningless advice, and that basing our life upon what we see everybody else do is not always a good idea. On the other hand, the goal is not to turn into George Bush, where we think we're driven by God who's talking to us and damn what everybody else says. We're simply going to go to war with any country that has oil. We're going to develop a different process. And this process the Buddha taught was the precepts of not causing harm. When we come up with an idea, rather than ask ourselves, what will my friends think, or does this sound like what God would have me do, which is even more scary to me, what we do is we ask, okay, is the impetus behind this harmful? Am I thinking this because I want to get ahead, because I want to hurt someone, because I want to get even, because I want to control something that other people can't have? What is the underlying motivation? Often we can test this by just getting to a place where we're really peaceful and just see what is behind when we think of this idea. When I have peaceful goals, I'm very settled. But when my goals have an element of harmfulness to them, there's always this sense of being driven behind it. There's always this sense of momentum and I've been victimized and I've got to get what's mine. So if we can analyze the gut feeling and the body states and just the momentum behind these thoughts, we can often see that some thoughts that seem like good ideas are in fact have this very sneaky level of insincerity and selfishness behind them. And as the more we become aware of the mind and the body, the more we can discern which of our ideas are truly harmless. Now you might say, well, everybody does harmful things now and then. What's the big problem? Well, the big idea is that when we do act out of harmful intentions, in the end we're creating a mind that's a very, very painful place to live in. Whenever we act out of selfish, harmful intents, disregarding for a moment what we do to other people, we're creating a mind that's violent, that's aggressive, that feels that it can only find peace by taking from other people or by acting in an aggrandizing, forceful way. And that's not a peaceful mind to be in. So finally, thought I'd talk about one example of making a big decision that I've learned from Ajahn Jeff that I find is really quite useful. He talks about this process where when we have to make a decision in life and we don't know immediately what the right thing to do is. If you do know what the right thing to do is, you're very peaceful, you know that your intentions are virtuous, you know that you're not doing it out of stress or panic, but that you're doing it out of generosity and gratitude, well, fine, do it. But if you're at a place where you don't know, then what you do is we sit down. We first get very, very calm and peaceful. We breathe and relax, and we find a state of abiding that's very tranquil. And it might take a little while, 10 or 15 minutes. And we've put aside the big decision we're contemplating. Once I get to that state of easeful abiding, then I bring to mind this idea, this decision that I want to make, and I ask myself, from this place of peace, from this place of ease, what would a calm person decide? What would a calm person do right now? How would they choose? And I just envision some state of calmness and I ask, what would somebody who felt no fear, no panic, no stress, how would they decide? And I just note if the answer comes out, I note what it is. Sometimes it comes up, sometimes it doesn't. Then I put aside the decision and I go back, I attain a state of peace, and then I move on to the metta meditation, which is, I say the metta phrase is, may I be truly peaceful, free of stress and suffering, may I be at ease, may all beings be truly peaceful, free of suffering and at ease. Once I get to this place of kindness to myself and others, I then bring the decision back to mind and I ask, what would somebody who is exceptionally kind and loving and compassionate do? What would they do for themselves, for other people? What would they decide? What's the most compassionate thing? I put it away for a third time. And then when I'm back in tranquility, I reflect on all the virtuous things I've done that in the long term I felt good about. All the decisions I've made that were helpful, that I felt a sense of esteem later on for enacting. Once I've gotten this state in mind, I then return for the third and final time and I ask myself, what would someone who is virtuous, who is not about harm or vengeance or self-seeking, but simply wants to be harmless and live at ease with his actions, what would they do? And so this type of process, what it does is it slows us down. It pushes away the idea that I have to make decisions out of panic, out of stress, out of peer pressure, out of habit, and instead I'm developing skillful mind states and I'm making the decision from these places of abiding, these very, very skillful mind states. It's a very different way rather than just falling into our normal driven, not knowing why we make our decisions. And the good news about this is that in my experience, with the decisions in life that I feel good about, in the long term, I'm almost always capable of explaining why I chose them. But the ones that turn out invariably kind of iffy, to say the least, are the ones that I'll often say, I just don't know what I was thinking then. I just don't know what. So this is an approach that adds a new technique to evaluating the big choices that we have to make. I hope that you got something of interest from it. I thank you for listening. And now is your turn to ask any questions at all about Buddhism, spiritual practice, or anything that I talked about tonight. So I thank you so much for listening.